From Missouri to Oregon, North Dakota to Alabama, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the American Legislative Exchange Council has released its annual Rich States, Poor States report on state economic competitiveness. Jonathan Williams of ALEC is here with details. Former President Donald Trump is working with Newt Gingrich and others to develop a new Contract with America. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The American Rescue Act is doling out billions of federal dollars to state and local governments. But Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains some states are already flush with cash. And journalistic standards of fairness have devolved to the point where ideology obscures the search for truth. So says Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Each year, the American Legislative Exchange Council publishes a comprehensive look at the tax and economic policies of the 50 states. Jonathan Williams is Executive Vice President and Chief Economist at ALEC. He is one of the co-authors of the Rich States, Poor States report. He joins us now to talk about this year's findings. Jonathan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jonathan, your 14th edition of Rich States, Poor States, before we get into exactly what the product is, tell us, how did this actually get started, lo, these 14 years ago?
Well, thanks, Loman, for having me back. It's really been an incredible project to work on since my first week coming into the job at ALEC. Is we had had Art Laffer, the great Reagan-era economist and the creator of the famed Laffer Curve, and Stephen Moore from the Wall Street Journal at that time, and now with FreedomWorks and other organizations, you know, come to us and say, you know, we've been ranking states for a long time. We've been watching what works and what doesn't. ALEC is in a unique position as the nation's largest nonpartisan membership organization of legislators out there, thousands who believe in free markets and limited government. Let's create a real product where legislators and concerned taxpayers and businesses all across the country have a way to really measure their state's policies against their neighboring states and against states all across the country. And of course, this really draws on the idea from the founders. And then, of course, as Justice Brandeis famously put it, the 50 laboratories of democracy and innovation. And the competition between states, whether it's tax competition or other ways that states compete with each other for jobs and for migration, is inherently a good and a virtuous thing, because when states need to compete with each other, people win and taxpayers win. And so this product, Rich States, Poor States, is all about this competition between states and highlighting what works and what doesn't.
As you prepare this report each year, Jonathan, what sort of criteria do you look at in arriving at your ranking of the states?
We look at 15 different equally weighted factors, and we've kept them the same all 14 editions of Rich States, Poor States. And that really has given us a nice way to look back in a time series, as we say, apples to apples comparison, to see how states have not only ranked currently, but how they've progressed or in some cases regressed, unfortunately, during these 14 years. And there are things like taxes and regulation and labor policy are three of the bucket areas that we look at. And pretty much every kind of tax, we look at minimum wage laws and how expensive that is. We look at right-to-work status in terms of the labor policy. And then we look at other things that we know matter for economic growth. And there's really two big reasons, Loman, and why we chose the 15 variables. And one, based on Art Laffer's 50 years of research in the area, we know that these are some of the most important variables for why some states grow and some states fail to grow. But also, just as importantly, Loman, we chose these factors because they're things that state legislators in capitals across the country decide directly and can change in really sometimes short order and make a difference when it comes to their competitiveness as a state.
Over the years, you've had an opportunity, Jonathan, to see which states do well, which states do not quite as well. So let's begin here by focusing on the all-star states. Who came out at the top of your rankings this year and why? And are these the same states we usually see there?
Great question. And there's definitely in our top 10 of our economic outlook rankings, many states that have been there for a very long time, going from 10 and working our way up to the top. I mean, you have South Dakota and Texas, North Dakota, Nevada, Indiana, North Carolina, Wyoming, Oklahoma, Florida, and then Utah at the very top for economic outlook rankings. And there's a lot of great stories to unpack there. But Leah, with Utah specifically, and this is really incredible, Loman, Utah has been at number one for all 14 editions of Rich States, Poor States. And I get to ask that question everywhere I go. I've been to all 50 states now doing these presentations around this great piece of research and really unpacking these results. I always get asked that question, and there's a couple of real factors there at play. And I think one is just Utah has a culture that they don't spend more than they have. You know, basic rules of economics. When you tax something, you get less of it, right? When you tax something less, you get more of it. Spending also needs to equal taxation. These are really important lessons that Utah has learned well. So they've been very prudent. They've tried to keep government limited over time. They've been, I think, in a way, also very innovative with how they approach different policy challenges that other states haven't even really started to address in some cases. Two examples there. One is when it comes to property taxes, a vexing problem for many, many states and local governments across the country. Utah has had now for more than 30 years on its books what they call the truth in taxation policy that has limited property taxes and has kept Utah taxpayers protected from these escalating property tax bills. But then secondly, and this has been in the news a lot lately with the bankruptcy of Detroit, of course, with Puerto Rico's debt problems and with so many other city and state issues in Illinois and other places, the massive unfunded public pension liabilities that threaten taxpayers and government services in so many places across the country. Utah, about a decade ago now, has really made some substantial reforms in that area to move to more of the 401k defined contribution pension model. So those are just two of the very innovative things that Utah's done to stay at the top for all 14 years. Really an incredible free market success story. And then so many other great stories in that top tier of states. It's just states that have successfully kept taxes low, have seen the in-migration, people continue to vote with their feet away from high-tax states and moving to states in the top 10 of our ranking.
In terms of those folks who are moving away from high-tax states, you talked about the All-Stars, and kudos to Utah for being there all 14 years. Who are the cellar dwellers?
And there's a lot there, Loman, states that have been there for a while as well. There's even the bottom four states, Illinois, New Jersey, Vermont, and New York. And no movement from last year. They had the exact same places. New York at 50th has been there for 8 years in a row now at this point.
The report is Rich States, Poor States. One of its co-authors, Jonathan Williams, who is executive vice president as well as chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council and our newest commentator here on American Radio Journal. Jonathan, tell us a little bit about ALEC and where can folks go if they'd like to read Rich States, Poor States?
ALEC.org is a great place to go read all of our great publications across ALEC is the nation's largest nonpartisan membership organization of state legislators across the country. Also, richstatespoorstates.org is a dynamic website that captures all of the 14 years of this ranking system and allows you to go see how your state ranks, but also allows you to see how different policies might change your state's ranking. So go to richstatespoorstates.org as well.
Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, thank you for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He keeps an eye both on legislation moving through Washington, D.C., as well as political developments across the country and some interesting developments this past week. Scott, good to have you here to talk about it.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Former President Trump is working on a special project these days with Newt Gingrich and some others, all of which is aimed at Republican efforts to reclaim control of Congress in next year's election. So, Scott, what's the former president been up to?
Well, Loman, I think former President Trump is looking ahead to the 2022 midterms. He's going to be coming out with some big rallies in the month of June. And on top of that, I think he's kind of trying to figure out what exactly can I take from my America First agenda and insert that into the political debate for 2022 as sort of a mandate of items that Republicans can run on and win back the House majority. So he's been working with Newt Gingrich and Lindsey Graham, who actually came into the House in 1994, alongside Club for Growth president David McIntosh, who was a three-term member from Indiana. That 1994 class really set the tone during the Clinton administration for how to handle divided government. And obviously, they won back the majority, and they were pretty effective in pushing back against Clinton's most outrageous ideas. So I think that that's something that President Trump wants to do. He wants to fight back against Joe Biden and the Socialist Squad. And he wants to put together a new contract with America with the help of some of these leaders that have been around and done that in previous generations.
What sort of issues are we likely to see included in this new contract with America, Scott?
I think that the new contract with America is largely going to be a lot of these items that Trump will go on a big stage and riff about anyways. He's going to be out there talking about immigration and how that deals with America First and closing the border. Right now we're seeing an outrageous amount of immigrants pouring across the border. I think everybody saw the drone footage from last weekend when one Border Patrol agent was chasing down 30 to 40 immigrants coming illegally to America. And then I think you also look at these major issues that have kind of sprung up during the coronavirus pandemic, and one of those would certainly be school choice. And we're also seeing in a lot of these higher education institutions and even in K through 12, critical race theory being taught and sort of a rewrite of American history. When you look back to Trump's speech on July 4th of last year over there at Mount Rushmore, he highlighted a lot of these ideas of really getting back to American history in the classroom. So I could see that being a big part of it too. Obviously, Trump has been booted away from Twitter and Facebook, so he's going to include something on fighting big tech, and then he'll also include something on fighting back against China. So I think he'll highlight his ability to get trade deals done. He also is probably going to be taking a look at how to advance the Trump tax cuts even farther and make those permanent. And then you can also look at the things that Joe Biden has sort of steered the country in the opposite direction. And I think that Trump will fight back against that when it comes to excessive regulation or the policies that's going on in Capitol Hill.
Looking ahead to next year in 2022, Scott, Republicans hopeful of reclaiming control of both the House and the Senate. Razor thin majority for Democrats right now in the House, absolutely tied at really 50-50 for all practical purposes in the Senate. In midterm elections, is history on the side of Republicans in their effort to reclaim control?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what happened in 2018 for the Democrats. You know, we're in a midterm following Donald Trump's election with unified government in the 2016 elections. The minority party typically gains seats in the midterm election following a presidential election. And so I think Republicans really have an opportunity to lay out what Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have done over the first 2 years and fight back against it. They want to defund the police. They want to enact socialism and grow the size, scope, and cost of the federal government. So Trump is going to basically be running elections with House candidates that need to defeat Democrats, and they're going to say, what exactly do the Democrats stand for? And if it's big tech censorship or the increases on investment taxation, I think that the Democrats right now are sort of boxing themselves into a corner because they're largely being led by the far left, who are the top communicators in their party. Even Bernie Sanders is seen as a leader among the Democrats, although he caucuses as an independent socialist. And so the Democrats really have no choice but to try to put points on the board during these first 2 years and hope that the 22 elections aren't as bad as they fear. But I certainly feel like Republicans in the House have a really, really solid opportunity to win back the majority. We're watching the redistricting, the way that the lines are drawn for congressional districts. Well, that'll be coming out this fall in most states. There will obviously be some legal challenges associated with that. But we know that once the lines are drawn, most of them are being drawn by Republican legislatures. So that should give us some advantage. I'm not saying that it's going to be gerrymandering in terms of redistricting. I'm saying that the lines are going to be fairly drawn. And we've also seen how apportionment has come out through the Census Bureau over the last few weeks, and we know which states are losing seats and which ones are gaining. So Republicans should be in solid position to take back the House.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., built underneath the umbrella of 500,000 members throughout our country. If anybody wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
The American Rescue Act, under the guise of pandemic recovery, is pumping billions of federal dollars into states that already have budget surpluses. For details, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
States with huge post-pandemic surpluses are still getting big federal bailouts. California, for example, is running a $75 billion budget surplus this year, but federal taxpayers are going to send the state an additional $27 billion anyway. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a close look at one of the provisions included in the American Rescue Plan. That's the $1.9 trillion package that Congress passed back in March to do a number of things, some related to the pandemic and a lot of them not really in any way connected to the pandemic. One of the things included in the American Rescue Plan was a massive bailout of state and local governments by the feds. And the rationale for including that is that state governments must have taken a huge revenue hit last year because of the economic shutdown and the other pandemic-related economic issues. But it turns out that that's just not true. California is probably the best example of this. As it emerges from the COVID-19 pandemic and keep in mind, of course, that California had some of the most brutal and draconian lockdown policies in the entire country. The state's coffers are literally overflowing. Governor Gavin Newsom announced last week that California expects to have a $75 billion budget surplus at the end of the current fiscal year. That is a staggering total. To put it in context, that amount is larger than the entire state budgets of 45 other states. And coming on the heels of a year that saw state and local governments begging Congress for a bailout, it should raise some serious questions about whether the $350 billion in aid included in the American Rescue Plan is really necessary. States are going to get that aid whether they need it or not, and California is not the only state that's not exactly hurting right now. In New Jersey, the state treasurer anticipates finishing the year with a $6.8 billion surplus. According to NJ.com, an independent fiscal agency in the state projects that that total will actually be even higher. Arizona, meanwhile, is sitting on a surplus of $1 billion. We have so many resources available, it's unprecedented, House Majority Leader Ben Toma, a Republican from Peoria, Arizona, told the Chamber Business News a few weeks ago. Texas was anticipating a budget deficit of about $1 billion as recently as January, but now the state is saying it's actually going to have a $700 million surplus. And that's largely because Texas has come out of the pandemic quicker than most other states because Governor Greg Abbott and lawmakers there lifted a lot of the lockdown policies and economic restrictions earlier than most other states did. And what do you know? That actually is the only form of stimulus that most states needed because now everything is booming. There are some exceptions to this situation, of course. There are some states that are running budget deficits. None of them, though, look that unmanageable at the moment. And when you look across the board of the country as a whole, last year's doom and gloom predictions of state and city fiscal catastrophes just don't seem to be panning out. The Urban Institute, a centrist think tank, estimates that state tax collections in March of this year were 10% higher than a year ago, even after federal pandemic aid is excluded from the calculations. Meanwhile, data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis shows that state and local tax collections for the second quarter of 2021 are running about 7% ahead of the total for the first quarter of 2020. The first quarter of 2020, of course, that was the last quarter before the pandemic struck. Revenue right now running 7% higher than it was then. So clearly states have come out of the pandemic, even if they experienced a dip last year, they've come out of it doing pretty well. To put it simply, this is not a crisis. And that's what makes the disconnect between what's happening at the state and federal levels so stunning. On the exact same day that Newsom announced this $75 billion budget surplus in California, the U.S. Treasury Department finalized its plan for disbursing the first round of American Recovery Act aid to states. California will get $27 billion. Texas, which is also running a surplus, as we discussed a minute ago, is going to get $15 billion from the federal government, from federal taxpayers. New Jersey, with its $6 billion surplus, is going to get another $6 billion from federal taxpayers. And Arizona, which is also running a small surplus, is going to get $4 billion. And those totals don't include the $130 billion in the bill that's earmarked for local governments, the $123 billion that's set aside for public schools, or the $31 billion that's reserved for public transit agencies. There's also money in the bill for Washington, D.C., for Native American tribal governments all over the country as well. All told, state and local governments are likely to be well over $1 trillion better off as a result of COVID relief legislation than they otherwise would be, according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a group that has been warning for months that Congress's bailout of state and local governments was likely to be overly generous and cause problems. Governments at every level are about to find themselves flush with more cash than they might know what to do with, but thanks to another weird provision in the American Recovery Act, they won't be allowed to return that money to taxpayers. That's because the American Recovery Act specifically forbids states from using federal aid to cut taxes or fund tax credit programs, including those that are commonly used to fund things like school choice programs. So governments are going to have a lot more money, and they're only going to be able to spend it on new government programs, not return it to taxpayers or use it to offset future taxes. And that means that some states, at least, are likely to take that extra federal aid and plow it into new programs that will then create funding obligations with state tax dollars in future years. This is a recipe for growing the size and cost of state and local governments. It's the same thing that happened in many places after the Obama-era stimulus after the last financial recession. State and local governments must be very careful about this. They should avoid using these temporary funds to support permanent policy changes that lead to larger future imbalances. That's a warning that the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget is putting out right now. In other words, state and local officials have to have a better sense of fiscal restraint and responsibility than their peers in the federal government, but, well, I'm not crossing my fingers. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bame. Check out more of our coverage of the American Recovery Act, of the Biden administration, of all the massive spending that's happening right now in Washington, D.C. at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Ideology, not fairness, or even the search for truth, dominates most news coverage today. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Last week, in an appearance on Fox News' Special Report with Bret Baier, pundit, broadcaster, and former Education Secretary Bill Bennett said something so simple and so true that it should be elevated to a modern meme. Here it is. Ideology has obscured the search for truth. The particular context of what Dr. Bennett decried was the question of the origin of the COVID-19 coronavirus, but the basic problem is much wider. It is the devolution of our standards of journalism. If there was a single major theme in the presidential election of 2020, it was that Joe Biden is the opposite of Donald Trump. Media coverage of Trump and Biden reflected the same polarity. Donald Trump was a liar, as the Washington Post gleefully claimed as it tracked and totaled 30,573 of Trump's false and misleading statements during his 4 years in office. One might expect that the Post would begin to count Biden's false and misleading claims. Even if they expected fewer instances of what they considered misleading or inaccurate statements, one would expect that they'd maintain a similar database, if only to make the contrast. But no. On April 26th, the Washington Post so-called fact-checker Glenn Kessler announced that the paper would no longer maintain a database of Biden untruths. There is no logical explanation for this double standard other than ideological or partisan bias. As Dr. Bennett pointed out, the ideology or partisan basis obscured the search for truth in the origin of the COVID virus. the major media all dismissed the possibility that it escaped as a result of a lab accident at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Anytime that President Trump raised that possibility, he was treated as a xenophobic conspiracy theorist, or worse. Now, all of a sudden, the possibility of a lab incident has come in from the wacky fringe and will now be treated at least semi-seriously by the Biden administration in a 90-day study. The major media have done a complete about-face in covering this story. How could such a thing happen? It caught the notice of New York Times columnist David Leonhardt. Here's what he wrote last Thursday. Quote, "It appears to be a classic example of groupthink, exacerbated by partisan polarization. One of the lab accidents theory's earliest advocate was Tom Cotton, the Republican senator from Arkansas. The media's coverage of Cotton's argument was flawed. Some coverage exaggerated Cotton's comments to suggest he was claiming that China had deliberately released the virus as a biological weapon. And some scientists and others also seem to have decided that if Cotton believed something, and Fox News and Donald Trump echoed it, the idea had to be wrong. The result was a bubble of fake consensus. Scientists who thought a lab leak was plausible received little attention. Scientists who thought the theory was wacky received widespread attention." End of quote. Well, that's a pretty tame mea culpa, but at the very least, it is an implicit admission of bias. Ideology obscured the search for truth. The same bias can be found in most coverage of climate change. While it's true that most scientists and climatologists agree that anthropomorphic gases do contribute to climate change, there are hundreds of respectable scientists who claim otherwise and who compiled huge amounts of data to back up their claims. Responsible journalism would report both claims and would be justified in stating that one view was held by a much larger number of experts than the other view. Instead, most major media coverage of the climate issue laud those who complain that climate change is largely due to burning fossil fuels and other human activity, while derisively painting those who hold to a different view as ignorant or, worse, intellectually corrupted by grants from energy companies. What has happened to American journalism that has resulted in such disregard for objectivity? In the 19th century, there were scores of newspaper barons who were deeply biased. Often the bias was partisan and even obvious from the paper's names, the Star Democrat or the Arizona Republican, for instance. Sensationalism sold papers. In the 20th century, journalism evolved into a much more honest and respectable purveyor of news, and schools of journalism arose to burnish the profession's standards of truth and reputation. American journalism has devolved, and once again, ideology obscures the search for truth. The consequence of this devolution is the profound division of our nation into two mutually incompatible sets of values, comprised of reds and blues. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WFCA-AM in French Camp, Mississippi, WXLI-AM and FM in Dublin, Georgia, along with WMAN-AM in Mansfield, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.